Two down, two to go. Welcome into our third hour of Sports Talk here on WWL, AMFM, and.com. Plenty to get to, recapping some of the Saints' moves that you heard there during the Sports Flash that Thomas Morstead has been released today. Joining us for this hour, Mark Menard at Master Control, Amos Morrell the third. Gentlemen, how are we?
Doing well. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great.
Good, Amos. Thanks for hanging out for the next hour with us. We're going to talk plenty of Saints, plenty of Pelicans for the next hour, but I also want to throw a bit of a curveball because this was born, this idea of having you and Amos and Steve kind of rotating between the three of y'all with me for once a week for the hours. We're going to give the audience a peek behind the curtain. So every day we hold a sports conference call, and we say some pretty zany, funny things in there, so we thought we could bring that to the radio. We talk some odd stories in sports in general, and I'll lead off with this one. Baker Mayfield is almost 100% sure he saw a UFO. First off, I need to know from both of you if you believe in UFOs and do you believe Baker Mayfield. And I'm going to start with Amos Morrell III. Go, Amos.
Mathematically speaking, there has to be UFOs. Like, it just can't not be UFOs out there. But I will say, I don't know if Baker saw one. It seems like the circles he runs in, it may not have been a UFO.
Okay, Mark?
Yeah, look, I also believe in it. I want to know, I want more information about what surrounded seeing this UFO. Like, what kind of things was he doing before he saw the UFO, if you get what I'm saying?
I mean, it is the off season, you know. He might have been, enjoying the off season if you catch him adrift.
And as he should. Yes. But I need more info.
See, I'm with you. I'm with you two guys. I don't believe in UFOs, so I'm not with you there. But I think that there might be Baker just enjoying the off season a little too much, and I think we've all been there at times where we're enjoying life a little bit and see things that aren't necessarily there. I don't believe in UFOs, so I've never really believed in them. I don't believe in Bigfoot. I don't believe in that. Same thing for me with UFOs.
Where's that? Does he live close to that SpaceX launch center place? Because that could be, maybe he saw them testing something out.
It could be. I don't know where he lives, but another one up for you guys. And again, we're going to get plenty of Saints football and the NBA as well, the Pelicans in particular. So a high school baseball team in California goes outside, takes a team photo, and was not wearing their masks, and they get suspended. Is that an overreach?
So my question would be, did they take the masks off just for the photo, or was it before? Because I almost wonder if the blame's not on them, if it's on the photographer who was like, you know what, let's just get one without the mask just to see how it looks.
No, I mean, that was their team photo, and they follow the policy that governs their state in California, the mask mandate in California. I know some states have walked that back, Texas and Mississippi, but California still has it. The bottom line is, okay, even they're outside, right? So we've learned that when you're outside, it decreases your chances, right? We've seen sports go on outside. There hasn't been one in the NFL. There was not one player-to-player transmission of COVID-19 from one team to the other, and one opposing player to the other. And if you're outside, that's what all the experts say. It decreases your chances. And if they just took off their mask right before they took the photo, I don't have a problem with it, in particular because they play games and practices outside in baseball without their masks on. If anything, if you're going to be critical about them not wearing their mask, if anything, don't suspend high school kids for doing that. That's just the bottom line for me.
Well, yeah, I obviously think that, you know, it should have been on the coach or, you know, whoever organized it, you know, should have found out, hey, how do y'all want us to do this? I don't think it's the kids' fault. You know, cause like you said, they probably just were told, hey, just pop the masks off real quick. Let's take this picture. It's got to be on, you know, the person doing the organization and the one that's in charge, in my opinion, to kind of figure out, all right, what's going to get us jammed up and what's going to get us, you know, what are we going to be fine with?
Right. Yeah.
Mark, jump in.
Yeah. I. What's the rule? Like, if they Did they actually break a rule, or are they making this up as they go along? So they're making this up as they go along. I don't agree with it at all. I think that's, you know, it you shouldn't punish kids, but you know, if it's, it kind of goes back to the conversation we were having yesterday about athletes doing stuff in their own time in the off season. Like, is it in the contract? Do they tell you in your contract you can't do it? If they tell you you can't do it and you do it, then I guess you got to pay the piper at the end. But if it's not in there and no one has any, no one tells you beforehand, then I don't see how you can come punish them after the fact.
Listen, the bottom line, though, is that the governor of that state, California, has violated his own COVID-19 mandates and been caught in public doing so and on photo, and he paid no repercussion whatsoever. So how can kids, again, these are high school kids, and you know how passionate I am about high school sports in general. I know all three of us really are to a degree. So the governor can violate a COVID-19 mandate in California, but if kids do it on a baseball field, taking a team photo without a mask, and they get suspended, I find that very much an overreach. It's just where I stand, and it's hard to convince me otherwise. And I think Mark brings up a good point, which is, you know, they're probably making it up as they go along, and making up the rules. And you certainly can't do that and then hold somebody accountable. All right, let's take our first break. Amos Morrell III, Mark Menard, Christian Garrick here on Sports Talk on WWL. All right, back here on Sports Talk, Amos Morrell III, Mark Menard hanging out for the hour. I'm Christian Garrick. We're going to get plenty of Saints and Pelicans talk. I got one more wild one here for you fellas. Amos and Mark, and it might be a little bit of a personal question, so if you don't want to answer it, you don't have to. But have you ever been, either one of you, ever been fired in the middle of your shift?
No, I have not. I've been fired before my shift after they had me come all the way down to work. And that wasn't fun, but no, never dead in the middle.
Amos?
I'm trying to think. I think it was my day off.
Okay. Well, Canadians, the Montreal Canadiens fired their goaltending coach in the middle of the game. Forget waiting until after. They just in the middle of the game, they said, no, you're done. Stephen Waite, the goaltending coach for the Canadiens, was fired after the second period of Tuesday's 3-1 win over the Ottawa Senators. That's even more bizarre that he was fired during a win. So the GM said it wasn't necessarily how he was coaching in the game, but he noticed he developed a pattern. The goaltending coach developed a pattern. I don't know what that means. That could mean several things. But, yeah, I've never been fired in the middle of a shift. It would be rather odd, in particular in radio. After 2 hours, they come in and say, hey, you're out. Somebody else is coming in.
What was the pattern? After the second period, he makes fun of the GM's wife? Like, he wanted to nip it in the bud happened again? I don't – like, what would the pattern be that, okay, mid-game, all right, we've seen enough, you're out. You can't even wait one more period until the game's over?
The story didn't conclude what the pattern was.
Closest thing I can think of to this was when – didn't they, like, kick Lane Kiffin off a bus? After the game. I think that was the closest thing I could think of.
Yeah, they're like on the way back home.
The Raiders, they fired him. They didn't. He had to pay for his flight home.
I mean,
that's brutal.
USC
did it to Steve Sarkisian. They pulled the bus over in the middle of the desert and took him off the bus. That's pretty rough,
sympathy for those two. I don't feel any sympathy for those two guys. They were well compensated.
Currently the goaltending coach.
Yeah, the goaltending coach for the Canadiens fired in the middle of the game. All right, let's get to some news today. First off, I want both of your opinions on Russell Wilson. And what I'm asking here is, give me a percentage chance that you think Russell Wilson plays for the Saints this fall.
I'll go first. I'm going to say 15%.
Well, that's confident.
You think that's – I don't think that's very confident. I just think that, you know, I think that there's a chance – I don't want to give it like single digits, but I also don't want to give it a lot. I'd say 15%.
So let me jump in here real quick, Amos, just to kind of set the bar, Mark.
Yeah.
I'll give it minus 15% chance.
Okay.
What is it? What do they say? You know, normally it kills 99.9%. I'll do that 0.1%. That's what I'll do. I just don't see of that list of teams. The Saints are, like, the only one that don't have someone that they could just say, all right, straight up swap. You know, Dak Prescott could go to Seattle. You know, the Raiders could send him Derek Carr. You know, there's guys that they're not Russell Wilson, obviously, but I don't know. It just seems like if he and if you're Seattle, why are you moving him? Like, just, you know, find some better offensive linemen.
Well, yeah, help him out. He's your franchise quarterback. Go ahead, Mark.
I was going to say, you know, the salary cap connotations for moving him as well are just not ideal for Seattle at all. You know, I think it's like a $39 million dead cap hit if they move him this year. So, no, I say 15%. I don't think that I'm confident that he's going to move. That's just what I consider to be a low number before you guys went all negative integers on me, and I didn't know that was even part of the scale. So, I mean, I guess I'll lower it to 5% in that case. But, no, I don't think Russell Wilson ends up here. But I think, you know, anytime you have a situation where a guy is disgruntled, it could end up going the way of Deshaun Watson. I don't think it will. I don't think Russell Wilson is that disgruntled, but there's always a chance these things could go south.
See, I actually think there's a better chance Deshaun could end up as a Saint because there's a chance that Deshaun won't be a Texan. I just don't see Seattle saying, yeah, look, Russ, like, we can work this out. Whereas I think the Texans are trying that and Deshaun doesn't want it. I think Russell would work it out.
You know, it wasn't just me that came up. I stole the minus 15%. And what I mean by that is I texted somebody in the league and asking that very question. What's the percentage chance that Russell gets out of Seattle this year and goes to New Orleans? And that's the response I got was minus 15% chance.
Look, you don't have to give away your sources, but was it Russell Wilson?
No, it was not. It certainly was not. I'm not that kind of connected, that's for sure. All right, let's get into some news from today. Thomas Morstead released today by the Saints in a cost-cutting move, drafted in 2009 as part of that Super Bowl championship team. He will forever be known as the guy that started the second half of that game off with ambush, the onside kick. First off, if you can reflect on Thomas Morstead, Mark, the player, but also what he means to the Houdat Nation and in the community.
Look, Thomas Morstead has been the model NFL player since he arrived in New Orleans. And you know, and by model, I mean he's been great in the community. I mean, he's been great at his job. And, you know, you never hear about that guy, you know, causing any kind of trouble. He's been, you know, just shows up to work and excels every single day he's at work, and been one of the best punters in the league since he got into the league. And, oh, by the way, he's also, like, the nicest guy off the field. So I think in every kind of metric you could propose, Thomas Morstead is right at the top in terms of, you know, what he's meant to the city of New Orleans and what he's meant to the Saints fan base. And you know, on top of that, he came up big in the most important play of his career. So, like I said, everywhere you look across the board, Thomas Morstead has been a model NFL player. And I think he made this fan base reassess the importance of the punter, because he became a legit weapon for this team. You know, on the off chance that this offense would stall and they'd have a bad series, he could completely flip the field with one swing of his leg, and he did it consistently every single time. So I think he's meant the world to this franchise, and, you know, that's why everybody's sad to see him go.
Yeah, you know, and I've been in that locker room a lot these last few years, and, you know, always gracious, always was a guy you could go to, you know, if you needed an insightful quote about the team. You know, he was a football player. You know, he didn't just know what was going on special teams. You know, he was tuned in with the game plan and whatnot. So he was always a great quote. You know, was always gracious, courteous, super class act when it came to getting interviews. So yeah, he was definitely a guy that, you know, there was a reason that he was, you know, considered a leader on that team. And, you know, you could see that in the way he handled the media, the way he handled his teammates. So, yeah, I definitely think, you know, it was definitely a sad and kind of, you know, you could tell this decision was one that the Saints probably, you know, it wasn't an easy one for him. You know, it was definitely an emotional one for, you know, all parties involved.
Amos Morrell III, Mark Menard, Christian Garrick here on Sports Talk. And we talked about Thomas Morstead, but I think Mark and Amos, we're going to see over the next 9-10 days, several guys either restructure or that hit the streets, not just for the Saints, but in the NFL as teams try to pare down and get below the salary cap. And it's going to be an interesting week. It's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah, and, you know, it's very interesting considering that you know, there's it just seems like there's so many guys that, you know, are under contract that are being casualties. And, you know, these are dudes you thought, like, all right, well, you know, they got him for another year. You know, names that are popping up that you didn't consider as guys that, like, you know, before today, you know, I was like, well, when they released Thomas Morstead, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. But, you know, that was a guy that I didn't think was going to be, you know, on this list at all. So I think that's the shocking thing, is that there's a lot of names that, you know, you wouldn't think are popping up.
Well, and I think, you know, the interesting thing to me is that, you know, one day when Thomas Morstead's career is over, I think you'll see him sign that one-day contract to retire as a Saint, which you normally don't see from a punter. You know, but he really has meant that much to this organization.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, he even said today in the press conference that, you know, that he had after the news broke that, you know, him and his family are building a house here. And, you know, they're like, well, we're not going to stop. Like, we live here now. So
right.
Yeah, you know, getting to some of these teams and these players around the league, in particular the Saints, for the most part, if I could describe it one way, is you went from shopping at Saks Fifth Avenue to now JCPenney. It's just, that's just the way it's going to have to be, just because of the salary cap. And we had a caller earlier, Amos, just to fill you in, critical of Mickey Loomis about the salary cap situation. And I don't fault Mickey Loomis or the Saints organization over the last 4 years for being all in tight against the cap, because they had a Super Bowl window, and nobody could have projected a COVID pandemic that would have forced the league to drop the salary cap because of lost revenue. I can't do that.
Well, and then, you know, it's not like the Saints are going to be the only team that are dealing with this. You know, there's some of these other teams that, you know, I can think of, like, the Jets are probably thinking that they were, you know, forecasting that they were going to have a lot more money to spend this year, you know, to go chase some of these big name guys and bring in some real talented players. And, you know, with the cap smaller, even though they've got a lot of space, you know, they're probably having to adjust the way they're approaching it. So, I mean, it's not just the Saints that are dealing with it. That are in better cap situations, I think, are, you know, dealing with the struggles of, all right, well, maybe we're not in for some of these guys we thought we were going to be in on.
I was going to say, it's not just that you went from shopping at Saks to shopping at Penny's, but Saks closed for the foreseeable future, and they'll reopen next offseason.
Yeah, very well, very good way to put it. Malcolm Brown, bottom line, do you think he gets traded or cut by the Saints?
I have a hard time seeing a trade getting pulled off, just because there's, you know, I mean, obviously there's always going to be a market for, you know, a really talented run-stopping defensive lineman. But, I mean, you know, if you're a team that wants him, you can just hold out and wait till he's released. And, like, you know, we've been talking about, you might be able to get him at that discounted rate because, you know, the cap's low. He might take less than he would normally be able to get for 1 year to come play for you. And then, you know, hope that next year the cap's back to where, you know, more normal level, and, you know, try and cash out then. So, you know, I have a hard time seeing a team wanting to pull a trigger on a trade, you know, because especially in the NFL, I feel like you see it a lot where, you know, guys are like, well, let me just wait and see what I can, you know, do, you know, to sign him.
Yeah, what you have to hope for is that a team gets worried that maybe there's going to be too many suitors and he wouldn't pick them. And they really want him. And I don't know if there's anybody out there like that for Malcolm Brown, but there might be, like Amos said, you know, run stuff and defensive tackles are always in vogue, and you need them on your team. So, I would say there's a greater than 5% chance that they get managed to find a trade partner, but I don't know. I wouldn't bet on it. We'll see what happens as it goes forward.
The answer to my question is, for me, he gets cut. Because teams do this all the time. They try to create a trade market before they're going to release a team to see if anyone bites, and nobody ever does. And everybody around the league goes, no, we know that you're going to cut them, so we'll just wait till you cut them. That's just how it works. So I think he's going to get cut, not traded. Trey Hendrickson gets a big contract this offseason, yes or no?
From the Saints or from anybody?
From anybody.
Yes. I think somebody's going to pay him. There's always going to be a team that's out there that's going to pay for a pass rusher, but I don't think the Saints are going to be the ones to pay him. Amos?
Yeah, double-digit sacks. I mean, that's – he wrote himself a check at that point. Like, you know, he's just – now he's just waiting to cash it out.
I would agree. It's not the Saints, and I think that there's always that team that doesn't value production, several years of production, right? We see it all the time. A guy has a one splash year, and he gets paid, and he gets overpaid, and then 2 years into that contract, the team's going back to that player saying, let's restructure that deal because we made a mistake ultimately in paying a guy that had a good year but not a good body of work over the course of his young NFL career. Now, some teams might say, let's take a gamble. Maybe you get him on a price that you feel like is good, and he continues to turn in 15-plus sacks a year. Then I think it's money well spent for any team. But I would be hesitant if I was a general manager to hand Trey Hendrickson that kind of contract, a big contract after 1 year of production. And I think aside from the salary cap, if money was not an issue from the Saints, I think they would be hesitant to pay Trey Hendrickson because they, like, if you go back and look, when they got right in the after the 2014, 15, 16, 3 years of below 500, when they got right, they started drafting players with production, signing players as free agents with proven production. And one-year splash guys typically weren't brought in by the Saints. And I think here lately, I think a good evidence of that is Jarris Byrd. Another good evidence of that is Stanley Jean-Baptiste when they drafted him. So I think they learned their lesson there. And that's why, money aside, if the Saints had the money to do so, I don't think they would pay Trey Hendrickson. Myself,
I think what Trey has to hope for is that somebody sees him as like a Rob Ninkovich, because you know he had the first couple of years of his career he was saddled with injuries and didn't produce because of it, and then he comes out and has like you said, the one big splash year now that he's healthy. And the question is he going to stay healthy? I think that's the biggest question for Trey Hendrickson. Is I don't know that his production is going to tail off if he's healthy, but is he going to stay healthy? Because we haven't seen it until this year.
So what I would add though, talking about, would the Saints pay him if they had the money? I definitely think they would. I mean, they've probably the most familiar with him, and I think that familiarity really plays a lot into, what they want to do when they're bringing in a player in. So I kind of see that, if money was no object, I think the Saints would pay him because I think, they're familiar with him. They know what he's like in practice. They know how he is in meetings. He did have the 1 year of production, but I think they, felt confident in, that, and that was the thing they said his teammates said all season, I think he may have played more snaps this year than he had the previous years. And, once he got that opportunity, it translated to sacks. So I gotta say that I feel like the Saints, if the cap was not an issue, I would definitely say he was coming back as a Saint.
The truth of the matter is that he's been banged up. So to be fair to him, this is the first year where he's been completely healthy, so maybe he could have achieved better totals, sack totals, the first couple of years of his career. I also think that's why you saw Cam Jordan's sack numbers dip, because they devoted so much attention to Cam Jordan, therefore allowing Trey Hendrickson to get free a little bit more. And I think he's a benefactor from other teams devoting so much attention to Cam Jordan, and his numbers were down a little bit this year. So that's just kind of – it's good to get several different opinions. Amos, that's a good point. Phone lines are open as well at 504-260-1870. We'll step away and come back. Amos Morales III, Mark Menard, Christian Garrick here on Sports Talk on WWL. The trio of Amos Morales III, Mark Menard, Christian Garrick here for this hour. Just kicking around some sports topics, some conversation about the Saints. Obviously, we talked a little bit about UFOs. I got another one for you. Let's start with Amos. There's a proposed rule change, Amos, that would keep NFL teams from hiring coaches until after the Super Bowl. Will this be good or bad for the league?
It's interesting. And it's one of those things that Sean Payton, we asked him about this during the season, actually, and he was very adamant about this. So the Saints are definitely for this rule change. But it's interesting that a lot of these, really good teams, like the guys that are on the Chiefs staff, the guys that are on the Bucks staff, I think if you wait till after the season, you might see those guys be, the prime candidates. Whereas like now it seems kind of like they're, they're taking the leftover jobs because these teams get impatient once they start seeing the names come off the board. So, yeah, I kind of think that it would almost be good. It would, definitely make playoff coverage a lot easier for us in the on the beat. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I've never understood why they don't just wait till the season's over for all the coaching hires. I know teams always want to get a leg up where they can. I just don't see where, I don't know, maybe if you've got your guy that you know is going to be the guy and you don't want to waste any time hiring him, but yeah, you would think that the best coaches are on the staffs of the teams playing for championships, and like Amos said, you know, like it speaks to why Eric Bieniemy hasn't gotten a head coaching job yet. It's like, why wouldn't he have gotten a head coaching job yet? He's, you know, piloting the best offense in the NFL right now in terms of, you know, offensive coordinator, and both, you know, both years he had to wait till after the Super Bowl to interview for any head coaching jobs, and maybe that's why he's getting, because I can't come up with another reason why he would be getting passed over other than teams getting impatient and want their guy right now.
It's been done before. Josh McDaniels twice, actually, Denver Broncos, and then we originally agreed to coach the Colts and then backed out later. It's been done before. I get it. I understand. I don't know either why Eric Bieniemy is not a head coach yet. I guess take a guess as to maybe he doesn't interview well, or maybe he's an Andy Reid shadow and people might not necessarily want to give him enough credit for designing that offense that he does. And maybe the presence of Andy Reid, whether he calls the plays or Bieniemy calls the plays, that's only me speculating. Now, I'm okay with this rule to not hire coaches until after the Super Bowl, but what about then you would have to push back the calendar? Because if you're waiting until after February, let's just February 7th, so you can't hire a guy until February 8th, right? So free agency, that gives you about 5 weeks to evaluate your roster for a new staff, which I think is extremely difficult, opposed to if you hire them January 5th or 6th after the season's over, then that gives you 2 months, 2.5 months to evaluate your draft process. You got to stand that up, your pro personnel reports for free agency. I just think you're going to have to push back the calendar a little bit.
Well, but teams who hire people off of Super Bowl staffs are doing it that way anyway.
Some. It's rare, though. Yeah, I know. But, you know, a lot of times, though, when those hires are made, the GM's already in place, and most of your pro personnel guys are in place. Most of your scouting department's already in place. When you hire, typically, most of the hires from the head coach comes a year after. What usually happens, I don't know if you guys have noticed the trend, but it happened when Sean Payton got here in 2006. When he got the job, he kept his scouts that he inherited until after the draft and then cut them and hired a new scouting staff. That's a common thing that coaches do, because there is a bit of a rushed process to getting acclimated to an organization and then relaying to the scouting staff what exactly you're looking for in a player, so they can find you the right player in the draft. So, I don't know. I think it's interesting. It's an interesting rule change proposal. If I know the NFL like I think I do, they typically are reactive instead of proactive, so I expect us to have this same conversation next year. I don't think they're going to get it done necessarily for the following season, for the 2021 season.
Well, and then one thing I think you got to consider, too, is if you are, you know, the Chiefs, or, you know, the Saints even in this instance, and somebody, you know, hires one of your guys off of your staff, you're now, you know, at the back of the line trying to replace that position, and all the top candidates are the hot young guys, or, you know, the up and coming names are gone already. So, you know, you don't want to be, you know, if you're going to be having an opening, you don't want to be sitting in the back of the pool just because you were good. You know what I mean? So I kind of could see the benefit, you know, even from the good teams in wanting to, you know, fill these positions with good candidates. You won't, if they're all gone by the time, you know, you want them to be, you want to be able to replace them with someone good.
Yeah, good point. So you guys are familiar with the Saints filling out their coaching staff. They reshuffled some guys around. They also added a couple, in particular, Chris Richard. They added Zach Strief to their coaching ranks. Who's your favorite either coach? What coaching move do you like the most, whether it's a reshuffle or a new face? Which one do you think will have a big impact?
I like the Chris Richard hire. I think that he was, you know, a strong member of the Seattle staff, and I think he was a very strong member of the Dallas staff, and I'm not really sure why they let him go when they reshuffled that defensive staff. I thought he was, you know, an up-and-comer. But I also like that he spent the last year sitting at home, because I feel like coaches who, you know, get fired and maybe they spend a year sitting at home watching the game, I feel like they come back with a renewed perspective and maybe some fresh ideas.
Amos?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to cop out on this one, but I definitely like the promotions they made from within. I think we saw that last year with Michael Hodges, a guy that they, you know, brought in to replace Mike Nolan, who went on, you know, took another job, and that worked out really well for him. So I really like that. I guess I would have to say I kind of like the idea of bringing up Nugent on the offensive line. He's a guy that's worked with that offensive line the past season. That offensive line has played really well, so he knows what those guys need to do. He knows how to coach them already. So I kind of like that move if I had to pick one. But overall, I definitely just like the fact that they promoted from within, you know, kept that continuity and that familiarity, you know, especially considering, you know, the limited, you know, who knows – what off-season activities they'll get to do, how they get to do it, if they might still be limited. So I like the fact that they did that continuity. But the Nugent on the O-line, I think, is where I would lean.
I also like the Zach Strieff hire, but I didn't want to cop out and pick the only guy I'm actually familiar with personally.
Yeah, well, if he pours the same energy and passion into his playing career along with his radio career, he'll be just fine. He'll be an effective hire for sure for the Saints. Mine is Chris Richard because of he paid his dues, and he certainly was an up-and-comer until he had to sit out last year after he wasn't retained by Mike McCarthy. I still don't understand why Mike McCarthy would not Richard. I think he's a rising star, and I think he's a defensive coordinator in waiting if Dennis Allen should move on to be a head coach down the line, just like we all thought that Aaron Glenn was a defensive coordinator in waiting. And he is now a defensive coordinator. After being a defensive backs coach for the Saints, he is the DC in Detroit.
And
Morrell III.
Real quick, I also like them putting the resources in to keep Ryan Nielsen. I think he's a real key cog in that defensive staff.
Yeah, I mean, he was coveted by LSU. Amos Morrell III, Mark Menard, Christian Garrick. This is Sports Talk here on WWL. All right, winding down here with Amos Morrell III, Mark Menard. I'm Christian Garrick here winding down the 6 o'clock hour with those two gentlemen. Mark and Amos, let's talk a little Pelicans basketball. They're at home tonight against the Miami Heat after losing to the Bulls last night. How do they match up? We'll start with you, Amos, against the Miami Heat.
Ooh, that's tough. I don't think anyone can cover. The Heat don't have anyone that can really, you know, match up one-on-one with Zion. And, you know, that's something that we've been seeing, you know, pretty much down this last, you know, couple months really in the season, is that they've been giving the ball to Zion. It's, you know, it's really about, is this which Pelicans team shows up, you know, and it's a good team they're going to be playing. So I got to expect that we're going to see, you know, that Pelicans team that can go out there and beat the Jazz and, you know, really fill it up, play some good solid defense.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, and we talked to Antonio Daniels about this last night. It seems like they lose focus when a team is coming in here that is maybe, you know, that I don't know if they see them as below par, but it's like, look, you guys are below par too right now. Like, the Bulls came in here and they had a half game better record than the Pelicans. And oh, and by the way, they beat you down pretty good last time you played them. So I don't know what the cause would be for any lack of focus in terms of playing these games, but it's obviously there. And you know, like Amos, like, you, all right, so you got Jimmy Butler and the Heat coming in tonight, and I would think the focus will be a little bit higher because you got a good team coming in, and we'll see how it plays out. But and plus, you're on national TV tonight as well, and I think the players do get up a little bit when they know that everybody's watching.
Yeah, and Van Gundy, you know, he always says that he doesn't want to use that youth that the Pelicans has as an excuse. But, I mean, you know, I remember being younger, and I remember, you know, when it was a big – anything like a big test or whatever, you know, you get amped, you get excited,
you get hyped up.
It's, you know, you kind of got to learn that consistent approach, you know, that consistent mental approach. So, you know, I got to think that some of that is on the fact that, you know, you're playing with a really young team.
Yeah, and I've said this all year. It was going to be an inconsistent roller coaster kind of season because of the youth, and you know, these guys are still kind of developing their game, especially, you know, Zion, who's only 20 years old, still developing their game and developing, you know, their defense and learning how to win in the NBA. It's a learned skill that you have to develop, and just like any other. And you know, you got a lot of guys who are still learning that. And it's when you have a team like that, it's always going to lead to an inconsistent season. You just wish it wouldn't be so frustrating and maddening the way it has been with the Pelicans when they play down to bad teams.
Amos, you're headed over there now, right?
Yeah, I'm going to be heading up there to cover it. Follow me on Twitter.
What's the atmosphere like these days?
So I got to tell you, the fans that are showing up, I believe they're up to 2,400 fans, if I'm correct, is what they're letting in. The fans that are showing up are being pretty loud. You know, when the season started and they were only allowed to have, I think it was like 700, you know, they were having to put a little extra crowd noise. You could tell they were playing, but like I haven't, these last few games, have not noticed the crowd noise at all, because you know, the fans that are going are pretty loud. Matter of fact, there was this one Bulls fan at the game last night, and I'm surprised the rest of the people, the social distancing probably saved him, because he was very loud and vocal about his support for the Bulls. And so the fact that the, you know, the people had to be farther away from him probably kept him a little safer than, maybe he gave him a little more confidence to yell the things he was yelling. But the fans that are going are loud. I'll say that. And you know, they're definitely letting the Pelicans know when they're doing well.
And you can hear them on TV letting the refs know when they don't agree as well.
Hey, this is Mark. Thanks so much for the hour, fellas. We'll do it again next week.
Absolutely.
All right. Coming up next hour, Peyton Ramsey, Northwestern quarterback, will join us. A little NFL draft profile. Also, a little NBA talk, and it's going to be a unique one. The NBA and LeBron James sitting out what I would call a equality discussion that they so love to talk about, but they're sitting this one out. This is Sports Talk here on WWL.